This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hello, Friday. How about we review the week? And we are going to follow the money this week from Capitol Hill to Beacon Hill, where legislators put a stake in the ground for roughly $5 billion in COVID relief money allocated to the Commonwealth. The question is, can they use it to right generational wrongs? And after a brutal string of accidents, MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak told us this week, hey, that infrastructure bill in Washington, kind of important here at home.
We are going to have to identify some new sources of capital funding. Obviously, we're hopeful federal legislation is going to be part of that answer.
Meanwhile, a company born in a Harvard dorm room was on everyone's lips this week as a whistleblower called out Facebook for putting money over the public interest.
There were conflicts of interest between what was good for the public and what was good for Facebook. And Facebook over and over again chose to optimize for its own interests, like making more money.
And in the mayor's race in Boston, twice as much cash, big name endorsements for Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu.
I'm endorsing Michelle Wu for mayor of Boston because it's time for a Boston Green New Deal.
But her opponent, Councilor Nisa Sibey-George, tells Channel 2 the only support that matters is the support from the people of Boston.
I'm hopeful to have the endorsement of every Bostonian come November 2nd. That is what I'm working towards, and it's what I've worked on as an at-large city councilor.
So come on in, pull up a chair, join us for all of it, starting with the latest in the Boston mayoral race. There's less than a month to go in the race. Has either candidate moved the needle for you? What case do you think they have yet to make to you, to the people of Boston? Do you think Michelle Wu is copying Marty Walsh's success playbook from 2013? Or the listening tour that Anissa Sibey-George is on, is that going to pay dividends in November? Tell us what you think. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. And join our panelists. This week we have Renee Graham, a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. And we have Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political columnist. Renee, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And Joe, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks, Tiziana. Great to be here.
So I'm going to unabashedly start in the horse race instead of in the issues, Renee and Joe. Mm-hmm. And I just want to get, Renee, your take on the status of this race in Boston with a little less than a month to go.
You know, right now, it would be hard to predict the winner. I actually think it's been much more subdued than what we saw in the preliminary. It's been a kind of very gloves on kind of campaign, although, you know, Sibey-George, you know, did cause a bit of a stir recently when she said that it's relevant. That was her word, that Michelle Wu is not a Boston native. And my question, of course, was, well, why is this relevant and to whom is it relevant? Because actually it's not relevant. It only reinforces Boston's parochial image. But that's about as much as we've had in terms of a real dust up between the two candidates right now. You know, I haven't paid that much attention to the polls because I don't know that anyone should at this point. But, you know, I think anything can still happen. But I do think that the tenor that we saw in the preliminary, is that sort of heat is much lower.
So you exposed that thread. So let's follow up for a minute here. On Wednesday, Anissa Sibey-George went on Channel 2, PBS here, to follow up on the comments you were talking about, Renee. What she was asked about those earlier comments about being born in Boston, implying that Michelle Wu, who was born in Chicago, might be less qualified to be mayor. Here she is.
I don't knock anyone for not being born in this city. Both of my parents are immigrants. I'm the daughter of two immigrants to this country and to this city. It certainly wouldn't disqualify them. I'm simply speaking always to my experiences, how they have brought me to this moment. And yes, those experiences are part of my life and my life. I'm born and raised in this city, and I'm proud of that.
So, Joe, to Renee's point, has that been the one sort of real source of tension in a subdued post-preliminary race?
Yeah, really the only source of tension. Unfortunately, it's been a very tame race. I've been a little disappointed in both candidates, especially Michelle Wu, who basically is running an endorsement campaign. Every single day she rolls out an endorsement, and that's not a discussion of the issues, just getting endorsed by people. And I wish she would talk about the issues more. Same goes with Anissa Sibey-George. Maybe because she doesn't have as much money or whatever, but she has been silent on a lot of issues too. And, you know, she's at least trying with her race, with her equity plan, but it's been a little too not enough.
So what would you like to see listeners from the race at this point? Does it need to be dicier and spicier? Are there issues that we're not talking about that we should be? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Renee, I am intrigued by this idea of there's sort of two tiers of stuff going on. There's money and endorsements, and we'll dive into the money a little more. We are kind of following the money today. But then there's Anissa Sibe George's argument that what we're really doing here is courting voters. And I wonder, is it that simple? Is it rubber meets the road with voters and endorsements don't matter? Because you watch like an Ayanna Pressley endorsement, right? And you think that's a really big deal in a race where all of the candidates, all the black candidates are out, and there are a lot of people who supported three other candidates who are now shopping around for who to support next.
I think endorsements do make a difference. I don't think that they, you know, hold the same weight that voters do on election day. But, you know, what if Congresswoman Pressley had endorsed in the preliminary? What difference might that have made in the final result? So I do think it matters. I don't think you can base your whole campaign, however, on, you know, this person supports me and that person supports me. I think it does come down to how you sell your policies. I agree with Joe, I think it's been very tame and also a little disconcerting. And my colleague, Marcela Garcia, writes about this in her column, the fact that both candidates have turned down forums on public education. Now, that's as big an issue in Boston as there is, and somehow they're not talking about this in a way that they can really engage. They both have education plans, but why can't they get in front of voters and actually talk about those plans and answer questions about those plans? So I think those are the things that it's really going to come down to, and I think the less people hear about that, the more it might actually suppress people's desire to go out and vote next month.
Joe, what about this idea that that people want issues? They don't want endorsements. They don't want politics. They want meat and potato issues that are going to affect them, and they want to hear from candidates. I know Anissa Sibe George put out a detailed plan this week around equity and justice. It included some interesting measures around policing, which has been one area where both the candidates have distinguished themselves and sort of analysts have distinguished the two candidates and their positions.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I totally agree with Renee on that one, too, that, you know, voters do want to talk about the issues and especially education. It's disappointing that they turn down these forums to get in front of actual voters and answer questions from actual voters. I don't like the fact that we just have a couple of TV debates and that's it. There should be more direct interaction with voters. And, you know, especially housing is the number one issue. Education may be number two. Those two things right there alone, we should be having separate debates on just those and maybe on mass and caste, too.
So I want to play some sound from Senator Ed Markey endorsing Michelle Wu this week.
Michelle is a climate leader, and she will make sure that the systemic changes are made in the city of Boston for every child, every family, every worker, so that they can live and work in a sustainable environment.
So much has been made, Renee, sometimes by the candidates themselves, about this difference between the big systems change focus of a Michelle Wu, things like climate, and the nuts and bolts, you know, pothole style focus of an Anissa Sibe George. Is that a false framing? Is that accurate? And where are voters going to show up for in the end? Are we at a moment after the George Floyd protests and a global pandemic where people have the appetite to be voting based on the big systems change stuff? Or is this going to come down to the sidewalks in my neighborhood?
Well, I think what people once considered the big systems change stuff is on their block now. You know, climate change is not this sort of esoteric idea that's happening in other places or in other countries. We know the impact this is going to have and is already having in Boston. So there's room for both. You can talk about climate change and perhaps a Boston Green New Deal, but of course you also want to talk about potholes and those kinds of, you know, issues that people think about day in and day out. But there's, you know, I don't know that there's that greater line anymore given, you know, what we know is facing this city in terms of how the climate is changing.
So, Joe, I'm going to peel back the curtain a little bit here and sort of get meta. One of the things that we've noticed in the last few weeks, if not months, here on Week in Review is that when we talk about the Boston mayoral race, we don't get a lot of calls. People are having trouble finding a way to sort of engage on this. I'm bringing it up because we also, you know, and this is a historic race. No question, historic race. Historic race with 25% voter turnout in the preliminary. Also something that we're noticing. And I think we're wondering, is it just too soon? Do people just not start sinking their teeth into a mayoral race until a couple weeks before? Or is there some other thing not lighting voters on fire? Now, maybe that's just a silly analogy, but it's something that's kind of been lurking in the back of our heads.
No, I think that's a legitimate thing to ask, is why aren't more voters engaged? We know how low the turnout was in the preliminary, and I don't expect the turnout to be that great in the general election. It'll be bigger, but not as much big as it should be. Right now, I look at the blame for the candidates, because they're, like I said, Michelle Wu, I'm endorsed by this person, I'm endorsed by that person. That's her whole campaign right now. Voters, she's not engaging with voters or challenging voters or talking about local issues she has a plan for climate change, but she hasn't really emphasized that yet. So, you know, time to get really involved in the issues and talk about things that voters are really engaged in and want to hear about.
So, Renee, over the next month, there are going to be, I think, 2 to 3 television debates. We're doing 1-hour town halls here at WBUR City Space with each of the candidates. What notes do they have to start hitting to excite voters?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there was this thought going into the preliminary that, well, people won't really start paying attention to this until after Labor Day. But we also saw how dismal those numbers were, so that didn't really kick in. You know, maybe when people start to hear from them in these debates and these town halls, that will get them more energized to start thinking about what they envision for the city going forward and which of these women they think is the best person to get the city where it needs to go. But it's hard to know. It almost doesn't feel like there's this historic mayoral campaign going on and this historic choice that's going to be made next month. I just don't feel it in the streets. I don't feel it from readers. They just don't seem to be engaged with this at all. So I guess when you actually start talking about things and not, you know, you start talking about housing in a real way and you start talking about what you're going to do about affordable housing and what you're going to start to do about education, then maybe people will change their minds. But right, and maybe they're just too jaded. Maybe they just know these are all kind of, you know, campaign curlicues that people say to get elected and then get in office and don't do much. But something has to kind of light a fire under voters, because as we know, turnout is going to be a big deal in deciding, you know, who wins this race.
So I do want to go to one other subject. But before I do, 1-800-423-8255, listening to Renee Jo makes me think, after the preliminary, John Barros was here on the show, and I asked him about the low voter turnout. And he basically said, I had said, John, all the candidates seem competent, caring, thoughtful about the city, you know, really want to make change. Why didn't more people turn out? And he basically said everybody knew we were going to be fine, right? There were no candidates anybody was scared of or organizing against. Everyone knew the candidates were strong. Anything to that?
I don't think that's really what happened, that people thought that all the candidates were great and that's why there was a low turnout. Is that what he said?
It wasn't his only explanation, but it was a thread of what he talked about that intrigued me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's what happened. I think if anything, you know, we saw candidates that didn't excite the voters, and maybe, you know, offering some really bold plans for the city. And I'm not talking about just like the Green New Deal. I'm talking about other bold things that people could be doing with everyday issues that people deal with. Policing, you know, it's good that Anissa Saibi George did come up with a policing reform plan. You know, things like that, I think, are what, you know, people are concerned about.
Okay, before we leave issues having to do with the Boston mayor, acting Mayor Kim Janey did light a fire under at least some people this week. Here she is announcing this week that next week on Monday, we will officially be observing Indigenous Peoples Day in Boston.
Observing Indigenous Peoples Day is about replacing the colonial myths passed down from generation to generation with the true history of the land upon which our nation was founded.
So it was, I would argue, a last-minute change, less than about a week before the day is actually observed. A strong pushback from the Italian-American community, of which there's a significant number in the North End. Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards called it a unilateral action by the acting mayor and said she was, quote, surprised and didn't believe it encourages the honest, transparent, healing conversation we need. I just want to get a reaction from each of you. Renee, you first.
You know, about 20 cities and towns in Massachusetts already recognize Indigenous Peoples Day, so Boston is late in its acknowledgement, but I do think better late than never. I agree with Lydia Edwards. There's more to be done. You know, it's not just about the recognition of this one day, but what do you do beyond that? There has to be not just a kind of reparative history, but also a reparative justice that goes along with doing this. I'm glad it's been done, but I hope that this isn't where it ends.
And Joe, I know you wrote a column on this week, and you weren't pleased.
Yeah, I just think, you know, the Italian-American community, like you said, was very upset by this. A lot of the, not all, but a lot of the Italian-American community. And I think they have a right to be just wiping away something that was a holiday that was very important to them. And, you know, Italian-Americans have suffered discrimination going back decades in this country, and they kind of felt like they were being ignored.
Renee, what about that?
I think anyone at this point should be able to acknowledge that Christopher Columbus is, to put it mildly, a problematic figure. No one is saying that the Columbus Day parade is over. No one is saying that people can't mark this day the way that they always have. But I do think it is important to acknowledge why this debate is being had, why people want Indigenous Peoples Day, because of what we now understand about Christopher Columbus, as opposed to what we learned about Christopher Columbus discovering, and I'm doing air quotes, discovering America. I think, again, people need to have these conversations honestly, and they can either be upset, or they could look deeper into it and understand why this is happening and why this is the time for it.
All right. Well, on Monday, we will have a live show on Indigenous Peoples Day. And one of several segments that we'll have is we'll be talking to some people from New Haven, Connecticut, where they actually chose to no longer celebrate Columbus Day, but they celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day and Italian-American Heritage on the same day. And we'll be looking at that on Monday on that show. Okay. Still with us, our panelists, Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political columnist, and Renee Graham, a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. So, did you try to delete your Facebook account this week? Did you try to delete it, but Facebook was down, and so was WhatsApp, and so was Instagram? Do you run your business on one of those apps, and did you take a hit this week? Also, were you surprised by what the whistleblower had to say? And then later in this segment, we're also going to talk about the roughly $5 billion the State House has to spend and how we ought to spend it. It's a lot of money, and there's a lot of need. Call us with your thoughts, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So one of my favorite questions, we're going to start with the Facebook whistleblower. Joe Battenfeld, how big of a deal are these revelations?
I think she raised some important issues. You know, I don't know how much, you know, senior position she had, or, you know, I know Facebook was trying to spin it their way to say she wasn't really that important in the company, but she did raise really important issues about, you know, how Facebook is controlling the narrative in this country and how they may be, you know, hiding really what they're doing. I think that's more important, is that they're not being straight with the American people about what they're doing. But, you know, on the other hand, I think a lot of people were using this whistleblower to, you know, go on a rampage of new regulations against Facebook. And I think that may be going too far.
So, Renee, on Monday, so the day after the 60 Minutes interview, we actually had your colleague at the Boston Globe, Hiawatha Brayon, tech reporter. He had a really interesting analogy about these revelations.
Not as spectacular as what came out in the 1990s about the tobacco industry, but it really is very similar to that. We found out, what had long been suspected, that internally the tobacco industry had known for decades that cigarettes were deadly. Now we find out that, at least not decades, for years, their internal research shows that they know perfectly well that a lot of their business policies are having negative effects on people.
If this really is like big tobacco, Renee, then this is a really big deal.
You know, the only difference, as Hiawatha points out, is that we're talking decades for the tobacco industry as opposed to maybe the last decade for Facebook. There's no question. This is a disgusting company. I do not understand how people continue to use Facebook. I was hoping it would stay down forever, but acknowledging how important Facebook is to businesses and how many countries use WhatsApp as its primary communication tool. But the fact is plain. Facebook understood how harmful Instagram is for teenage girls and essentially did nothing about it. And so when teenage girls began to talk about suicidal ideation and talking about feeling worse about themselves and experiencing depression, Facebook didn't care. They knew all of this. And that's just one small part of it. We're not even talking about the ways that Facebook is absolutely detrimental to our democracy and has been, you know, for at least the last couple of election cycles. You know, this is a company that is too big and too powerful. And something has to be done because it's not going to change itself.
Listeners, there was a time when Mark Zuckerberg was celebrated as the entrepreneur of, like, the forever. And now we have Renee Graham saying Facebook is a disgusting company. I don't understand how people can use it anymore. Where are you? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation, I want to pick up on another thread, Joe, of what Renee just said. She talked about democracy, and this really stuck out to us on 60 Minutes on Sunday. Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, spoke out about her leaked of the company documents, talking about what Facebook does to society.
When we live in an information environment that is full of angry, hateful, polarizing content, it erodes our civic trust, it erodes our faith in each other, it erodes our ability to want to care for each other. The version of Facebook that exists today is tearing our societies apart and causing ethnic violence around the world.
So at one level, Joe, I mean, that's breathtaking. The thought that there is a company that is literally causing ethnic violence. At another level, I think about, oh, all the case studies you learn in college, right, about companies that are in extractive industries and responsible for deforestation or the suppression of indigenous people. You learn about Enron in the, you know, the late 1990s, early 2000 and the corruption there. Do we have appropriate expectations of private companies? There is a pushback that says, of course, Facebook acts in its own interests because it's a company and it's what it's supposed to do, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go after Facebook, then you should go after other big social media companies like Google as well. They arbitrarily decide what content you see most prominently every day and control a lot of the narrative in this country. So it's not just Facebook that we're talking about. We're talking about a lot of social media companies that are really controlling, you know, what people are thinking in this country or what people are seeing in this country. And it needs to be we really need to have a meaningful national discussion about the future of the digital age and, you know, how much we should be involved in regulating it. Should we be involved in regulating it at all? You know, I don't think that I did not delete my Facebook. I don't use it a lot, but I didn't delete it. I still think it has served some purposes, but I don't rely on it for my news when a lot of people do. I certainly don't think people should rely on it as a news source.
So let's hear a little more from Frances Haugen. But this time, this is she originally released her documents to The Wall Street Journal. They did a podcast, and she was one of the episodes. Here she is talking to The Wall Street Journal.
A thing that I want people to remember is, like, to do this project, I had to do a lot of work. Like, to document the things I documented at the level I documented, it took a lot of work. And you can't do those things if you're driven by hate, because hate burns you out. If I could work at Facebook again, I would work at Facebook again, because I think the most important work in the world is happening at Facebook, because we have to figure out how to make social media safer.
She's referring there to the work she was originally hired to do when she worked there that led to these revelations that she revealed after she left. Renee, this is so much on my mind because here she is saying, I would get back in there because we have got to solve this problem. But this problem algorithms feel so big and so amorphous. This thing is so huge. Almost 3 billion people around the world use it. have we lost control of something? Do we have something no one can fix? Or is that just a cop-out?
You know, I can't say off the top of my head that I know how you fix Facebook. I can say I know something needs to change with Facebook. You know, we've gone from, hey, you know, connect with your friends and family, to this information harvesting monster. And the way that they can dictate the topics that concern people, the fact that Facebook overwhelmingly is where people get their news from. If you think of some of the nonsense and mistruths and misinformation that Facebook deals in, that's terrifying for a democracy. And Facebook isn't interested in doing anything about it because Facebook is making a ton of money. There's no compelling reason for Facebook to change. So either users have to start leaving in droves, which I don't think is actually happening, you know, or someone has to step in and say, this is what we need to do. And especially when you have a company like Facebook that owns WhatsApp and Instagram, that's a lot of information and communication in the hands of one company.
1-800-423-8255. Are you terrified? Is this getting too big to control? Join the conversation. I'm thinking again, Joe, about that quote, that cut we just heard from Frances Haugen with the lovely podcast music in the back. I want podcast music behind everything I say on air, too. It just makes you sound much cooler. And Joe, what I found myself thinking also when I was listening to her is, you know, we in local news, I think we hold a fundamental belief that all things start local, and that means solutions start local. I look at this one, I don't know what the local start is here, Joe.
I don't know, you know, exactly. You mean like local, like regulating the Facebook?
Yeah, just solve it in your own community. You start in your own neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, how does that even work in something like this?
I don't know. I guess you could establish groups, of, you know, that are designed to, you know, inform people about Facebook and what Facebook is doing. And I do think there is some individual responsibility here, though, that we're not talking about, which is that people should not be just relying on Facebook for their news or for, you know, deciding how to think in this country. You have to have some individual responsibility and lay it on people's, you know, that it's not all just Facebook. It's individual people that are doing this.
So I'm going to let us go out of this subject with a caller. Marlena is on the line in Watertown. Marlena, you have last word on the Facebook subject. Go ahead.
Yes, for a long time, you know, Facebook served a purpose. It gave us a platform to share ideas, to share pictures with our families. And now it's come to the point where they're monetizing everything and putting money over the safety of its users. I am an activist, and I use Facebook and Instagram to spread awareness about social justice issues. And Facebook has served the community in many ways. And I do love that about Facebook, but I don't like the fact that they sell our data, that they use, you know, our platforms to, you know, propagate their own agenda. And that is wrong. They need to be limited by the government.
And there it is in a nutshell. Marlena from Watertown sums it all up for us. Thank you, Marlena. All right. I am going to shift gears. There's one other subject I want to get to. I'm going to go into it by playing some sound from State Senator Adam Hines. He heads the Senate's Special Committee on Reimagining Massachusetts, Post-Pandemic Resiliency. We spoke with him earlier this week. Here's what he told us about what they'd like to do with COVID relief money.
We were deliberately trying to address the vulnerabilities that resulted in some communities having a more dramatic impact in engagement with the virus. And time and time again, it came back to generational wealth gaps, income gaps. In each of the areas that we went through, we decided, look, let's go at the big investments. How do you approach underbanked communities? How do we elevate intergenerational wealth transfers?
So about five categories of big investments, and State Senator Karen Spilka, the president of the State Senate, told us about those this week as well.
Whether it be digital, care economy, economic housing, transit, educational, to take a look and really be intentional as to how we build back to better.
And I do want to be accurate. When I say us, I mean the greater Boston us. She was not actually on Radio Boston this week, but Adam Hines was. So this is an attempt to take $5 billion and right some generational wrongs, Joe. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should start start spending it. You know, we shouldn't be hoarding it the way the legislature is right now. And I just don't trust the legislature to spend this money correctly. We need, money to help inner city schools, education. We need money to help small landlords, small businesses prevent evictions and, stay alive. This country needs a lot of, infrastructure improvements, obviously. That goes without saying. The T needs fixing. So let's start doing it now. I think the legislature is holding back because they want to determine what they want to spend the money on and not let the governor get credit for it. And so then later when they put out their press releases on how much money they've given to local people, they can take credit for it. So I think there's a little bit of a game going on at the State House, unfortunately.
Call us and tell us where you want to see the money go. 1-800-423-8255. Renee, the legislature has been very clear. They did want to take their time. They wanted to develop some kind of strategy. Governor Baker over the summer was saying, we got to act now. He wanted authorization. He wanted to have control over more than $2 billion of that money to get it out fast on things like small business aid. In the end, it clear that the majority of the money, nearly $5 billion of it, $4.8 billion, going to that slower, steadier paced approach by the legislature. Joe says he doesn't trust it, that it's going to get where it needs to go. It's a lot of money, but we're also 18 months into the pandemic already. Where should speed fit into this picture?
I think the money should be spent, but I think it has to be spent smart. And I think you have to understand and look at where the needs are. And when State Senator Hines was talking about reimagining Massachusetts, I started to think about all the ways that the cracks in the state were laid bare during this pandemic. And so schools closed down and kids had to now learn remotely. But they didn't have the digital access to be able to do that. So you have to deal with that. You know, when we learned in a different kind of way because of people getting sick, that how many multi-generational families there are in this state and what that means, there are people taking care in some cases, not just of their children, but also aging relatives. What are we going to do for those people? Because not everyone feels comfortable now with their loved ones in a nursing home, knowing what happened in assisted living facilities and nursing homes during the pandemic. These are issues that would never have been addressed any other way. And I think when you come through this kind of grief and sorrow that isn't even over with the pandemic, you have to figure out a way to come out of it better. You have to build a better society. And I think when you're talking about economic opportunity and housing and the T, because the T is, boy, the T is a whole other mess. You have to figure out ways to make this work, but you have to do it smart. You can't just go spending on things and still not deal with these generational issues.
And just to point out, housing, transportation, the digital divide, all parts of the priorities, and care work, right? Older adult care, child care, all part of the priorities that were in this report. I want to get Emily in real quick from Somerville. Emily, briefly, go ahead.
Hi, yeah. When we're talking about using some of this money on building back better, I also want to raise the point that arts and culture across Massachusetts do a lot of the work that we're talking about. During the pandemic, how many of us were connected when we felt most isolated by virtual performances? And the arts and cultural sector in Massachusetts is really hurting. In fact, the Mass Cultural Council reported that arts and cultural nonprofits, 1 year into the pandemic, lost more than $500 million. We need to make sure that the things that make us proud to live in Massachusetts, that connect us to each other and to our communities, are still here when we're able to go back and feel somewhat sense of normal.
Emily, right? Do you work in the arts and culture industry?
I do. I'm the executive director of Mass Creative, a statewide arts and cultural organization. And I've been hearing stories for the last 2 years about the losses in the sector and the people who work in the sector who are really struggling right now and want to contribute to their communities as artists and creative workers, but need help.
Emily, thank you so much for the call. So I am going to deliberately juxtapose some sound from Steve Poftak, the MBTA general manager, earlier this week on Radio Boston with what we just heard from Emily. Here he is.
We at the MBTA have been investing in modernizing the system. We have been addressing safety issues. We have worked to build a stronger culture of safety, but it's clear it's clear that it's not enough and there's still more work to be done. And I think there's no one at the MBTA who thinks we're done.
You both mentioned the T. That is, you can't get more sort of roads and bridges, nuts and bolts than the T. And we know that there have been a series of accidents and tragedies on the T, that infrastructure is an issue. Then you've got Emily talking about arts and culture. It feels like with $5 billion on the table, we ought to not be pitting transportation against arts and culture. And yet, there's just never enough, Renee.
You know, $5 billion sounds like a lot, but given the issues that the state is facing, it's easy to burn through that money really quickly. I do agree that arts are extraordinarily important in the city and in society. Arts are what civilize us. Arts are, you know, our creative outlet, you know, and I think there should be a way to address that as well. But, you know, the T is a big deal. And, you know, throughout the pandemic, I've been working at home, but I kept getting T alerts and I couldn't figure out, like, there's barely anyone on the T. How is the T still breaking down all the time? Why are there delays? Why do they have to get buses to get people where they need to go? You know, you can't keep ignoring the T and think of yourself as a major city. You have to have public transportation. And I'm just not sure that the T is a reliable way of doing that. So, yes, you have to address transportation if you're going to make things better.
And, Joe, it's going to take money.
Yeah, and it's not just investing in infrastructure and, you know, fixing the T. It's also ending what I call the cone of silence, where the riding public has no idea how accidents occur, what's being done. You know, we need to stop the spin, apologize, spin cycle of how they handle every crisis, because every time there's an accident, it's like, oh, we're sorry, we don't know what happened, we're going to investigate it. You know, how long do we have to keep doing that? And, you know, we also, you know, stand up to the Carmen's Union, better supervision of how these workers are doing their jobs, more inspections, rules for drivers, and maybe, you know, do something radical like put the T directly under the governor's office control. That way you have somebody who is directly responsible for it. I know the governor controls the T board of directors, but there's a layer, you know, that sort of protects him from taking responsibility for the T a lot of the times. I want to hold somebody directly accountable for what's happening at the T.
That is intriguing. And this is why I love Week in Review and our analysts, because we get into the policy nitty-gritty in a way that you often don't have time for otherwise. That was really satisfying. I do, however, want to leave a little bit of time for our hubbubs, which are those brief local stories that caught our attention this week. Renee, what'd you bring us?
As you might have heard, one of our great traditions returns Monday with the running of the Boston Marathon. The Boston Athletic Association, however, is advising its runners to forego a more recent tradition, its origins unknown. Kissing spectators at the halfway mark, also known as the Wellesley College Scream Tunnel. After all, we are still very much in a pandemic, so runners, please take the BAA's advice this year and keep your lips to yourself.
Ew. Yes, I'm all for that. Thank you, Renee. That's a wonderful public service announcement anytime, actually. All right. Joe Battenfeld, how about you?
Yeah, I'm for that as well. But, you know, have you ever heard of something called lunch shaming? Mm-hmm. It's an actual thing, lunch shaming is, where kids in schools either don't get access to meals that they need or are sort of ostracized for, you know, low-income students, you know, and put in a separate group that people know they're getting assistance for lunches, they're getting free lunches. You know, there's a bill on the legislature that the legislature just passed to target lunch shaming and to eliminate the so-called practices, and that it would prohibit schools from publicly identifying students who have not paid for their meals. It's on the governor's desk right now. He should sign it.
Joe, thank you for that. I appreciate it. Once again, important public policy stuff. All right, I'm going to take a little bit longer. I do not have a hubbub this week. I have a hubbob this week because Bob Oaks, hosted his final Morning Edition show here at WBUR this morning. And I am going to get a little emotional. I have started my day with Bob Oakes for about 25 years. He is the voice of the world to me and to so many of us here. I was lucky enough to stand in the control room of Studio 2 this morning and watch him with his dear friend and our dear colleague, Robin Young, here and now host, co-host, say goodbye as he goes back to reporting and leaves his Morning Edition chair. The most intimidating interview I ever gave as a nonprofit leader was to Bob Oakes. I've done national, I've done global. Bob's was the most intimidating. He probably doesn't know that, but I knew he knew his stuff. I knew he was going to ask what had to be asked. I knew he was going to stay on me about it. And I respect that. But he was also so good at bringing us joy. And I want to give you just a little bit of sound from my hubbub. Here he is back in January, giving us a bit of the weather after a story about New England sea shanties.
Small craft advisory in effect for tonight through tomorrow afternoon in the harbor that is off Boston. The weather tonight, rain moves in. As Amelia said, you didn't need a trained singing voice for this.
Bob, you are simply the best. We absolutely love you. We're going to really miss you, Bob. Thanks. All right, folks. Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor, thanks for joining Week in Review.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political columnist, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Marathon Monday's coming up. Feels good to say that after last year's race was canceled due to the pandemic. In fact, it's been more than 900 days since the last in-person traditional Boston Marathon. It was April of 2019. Alex Ashlock, as you know, helps us cover the marathon. He is back with us to give us a preview. He's been covering the marathon for two decades. Alex, welcome back. Have you been counting the days to this weekend and to Monday?
Well, you know, the Boston Athletic Association actually did that for me. They gave me that figure, more than 900 days since the last in-person Boston Marathon. In fact, Monday, Tiziana, will be 910 days since the April 2019 Boston Marathon. So that's a long time, and it's just so great to be back here downtown.
And you are downtown right now.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. I'm in Copley Square, where there's a lot of people down here. There's a fan fest tonight, something the marathon has never done before. So there's, you know, excitement's really building for Monday like it usually does on that spring weekend in April that we're so familiar with.
Okay. 125th, not in April. Yep. It's October. What's going to be different?
Well, first of all, the field size is smaller because of COVID-19. They're trying to take all these measures to sort of keep people from being crowded together. It's usually 31,000 people, but they cut it down to 20,000, and actually that figure is going to be less. It's probably going to be about 18,000 when things get underway on Monday. And as we speak, runners are coming to the medical tent here in Copley Square to show proof of vaccination, or if they don't have that, they have to take a COVID test that hopefully for them comes back negative. And if you don't meet one of those requirements, you can't compete on Monday.
So, Alex, I'm going to take a time out for a second, because as I'm hearing you down there and you're just talking about the COVID test, the tent, I am just thinking back to you and I talking to each other live the day that they had to cancel the marathon when all of this started. And did you ever think you'd be seeing what you're seeing right now and preparing for this marathon on that day in dismay when for the first time it was canceled?
Yeah, you know, I guess, off the top of my head, I sort of didn't think we would ever see this day again. It just looked like, when will you be able to get thousands of people together in a road race? You know, 30,000 people in Boston, that's 50,000 in New York City. I mean, these marathons are huge. And people are packed together. So I was really, I really thought that maybe we had seen the end of these kinds of events. But thankfully, it looks like we're back to seeing them happen.
So the runners have to be raring to go. How are they preparing?
Well, you know, there was this virtual marathon last year where people ran wherever they were, and they kind of celebrated the fact that they were missing the Boston Marathon with their own personal marathons. Thousands of people did that. And it was a great thing to see people finish, even down here in Copley Square near at the finish line, the regular finish line. That was a great thing to see. But I think the bigger picture really is that during the pandemic, running became I mean, it's an outlet for people, but it really became an outlet for people during the pandemic because it was something they could do by themselves. And that's certainly true for Alana Cassidy. She lives in Hopkinton. She'll be running Boston for the 8th time on Monday.
Yeah, I've really, really enjoyed running during during COVID and having a safe outdoor activity where I could just, you know, get out and be active and have some time to reflect and think for myself, and not necessarily have a race to train for, but know that at some point Boston would be back. I knew it had to return.
So that's the solo dimension, Alex, but there's so much community, too. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, there's this whole running community, and just personally for me, I get to see these people like Meb Keflezighi, who won the 2014 race. I just spoke with Des Linden. She won in 2018 in that monsoon. She's back again. She's run the race, I think, 5-6 times. These people just come back to Boston. I mean, those people won the race, of course, so that's a reason to come back. But they love this event. They love the city. I think about Tatyana McFadden, the wheelchair racer. She's won here 5 times, and she just talks about how great it is to be here and how much the people of the city love the marathon. These runners, these athletes, they're part of the race's history and sort of the fabric of the event, and they come back even if they aren't going to run the race, like Meb Keflezighi. He'll be there here this weekend, but he isn't running.
Have you seen anyone else, Alex, since you've been down there that surprised you or you weren't expecting to see, or you were like, oh, there they are?
You know, I tell you, I've seen some younger runners who are part of the elite field who I'd never met before, who are here for the first time, and you can just see the excitement in their eyes and hear that in their voices. To take off on this incredible journey from Hopkinton to Boston. And, you know, I think if you win the Boston Marathon, it changes your life. I think it can change your life if you run it successfully as well. So I think we're just going to be seeing that all day on Monday.
We had a gust of wind there. It really brings it home that you're in the spot in the moment. Okay, so last question. It means a lot for the city, doesn't it? Even though it's not happening when it usually does on Patriots Day.
Yeah, it's really important for the city, and the runners have been telling me that today. Even, like I mentioned, Des Linden, she said, you know, this is just a great thing for the city, for the race to come back. It's part of the fabric, as I said, of the city. It's part of the spirit of the city. It's a sign on the calendar every year, even though it's in the fall this year and not in April. We're still marking a signpost in Boston, and it's just an event that, you know, I love it, obviously, and I think the city does too, and it's just so great to see it back. You're hearing probably the music in the background. They're getting ready for this fan fest tonight. They're going to be honoring some people, a women's running pioneer who finished first here 3 times at a point when women were not supposed to run the race. They weren't welcome. This is Sarah Mae Berman. She'll be honored and recognized with a banner on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of her final victory. That was in 1971. Women weren't officially allowed in the marathon until 1972. The BAA also honoring, or recognizing, I should say, Anna Brown Jackson and Michael Monroe Sr. They are the grandchildren of 2-time Boston Marathon champion Ellison Brown. They'll be accepting a banner on behalf of their family. Ellison Brown was a member of the Narragansett tribe. He took first place here in Boston in 1936 and 39.
Yep.
And, of course, Monday, when the marathon will be running, is Indigenous Peoples Day. So that's going to be something to recognize and celebrate tonight.
All right.
As well.
Alex Ashlak, we are out of time. Thank you. We look forward to talking to you again Monday.
You're welcome.
That is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.